and you're going like, oh my goodness, the looming disaster everywhere. My daughter and I were just talking about it as we were coming, riding up here. our freedoms being taken from us, freedom of speech. Our country being inundated and from within being changed. And not in a good way either. It's easy to get caught up in it. It really is. But for us, knowing the truth, we do have some help. We can look God's Word. We have strength in each other. We know that Jesus is there. We have faith in Him. And at times, we do need to be strengthened. We really do. One of the things that helps me is some scripture that's in Philippians 4. Let's turn there and look at this. If we have the knowledge of God, and if we have faith in Him, we can rest assured on these scriptures. And this is Philippians 4, starting in verse 4. It says, "Rejoice in the Lord always. I will say again, rejoice. Let your gentleness be evident to all, for the Lord is near. Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your request to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Jesus Christ." Now, that's something we can really get a comfort. I do. We can all get comfort from that. We're living in a world, but we're hoping to see a new world. And that's what we should think about more and dwell on. Let's go to Revelation 21 and look at what God says about the new world that is coming. Revelation 21 and verse 3. It says, "And I heard a loud voice, and from the throne saying, Now the dwelling of God is with men, and He will live with them, and they will be His people, and God Himself will be with them, and be their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain. For the old order of things has passed away." This is what we're looking for. This is what we have our hope in. This is something we need to think about when problems come up. And when you see others in pain and suffering, which is so prevalent in this world. And all the disasters and everything that looms over us. I'd like us all to keep going and preserve the faith and trust in God.
The title of this message is Keeping Worship Pure. We're going to tell you the story of a boy king. It's a true story from Judah's history, the story of a boy king. Jezebel's daughter married the king of Israel. You know how evil Jezebel was, a priestess of very terrible pagan religions. Anyway, her son dies in battle, and she decides she wants the throne. Her name is, I think it's pronounced Athaliah. And Athaliah, so there are some other sons of David besides her son who's died in battle from some of his other wives. So she plots and has, they're all young boys. She has them all murdered. Except the high priest saves one. And probably she wanted to get rid of the lineage of David because that's the kind of thing the devil would want to do. But God was not going to allow that to happen. So the high priest saves one small boy. He raises him secretly inside the temple. I guess only a few of the top priests know he's there. 6 years later, he's probably more like 12 or 13 now. By the way, in the meanwhile, Athaliah pulls Judah into terrible pagan corruption. You know, temple prostitutes, though, they set up a false temple of Baal right next to the real temple. They take a lot of the, you know, gold and silver and all those special things in the God's temple and move them into the pagan temple of Baal, and it becomes the official worship place. And obviously the country isn't doing well. So the high priest calls secretly many of the leaders of Judah to come in and meet with him, and he shows them, here is your king. He's probably only 12 or 13. Here is your king. He's a direct descendant of David, which was a big deal, you know, to the Jewish people. Still is a big deal, as a matter of fact, to the Jewish people. And then the queen hears all this commotion. She comes over with her guards to the temple, and suddenly the temple police from the high priest rush over and grab her. And her guards look around. They can tell the majority of the army and the leaders are on the side of the high priest, and she is taken out of the temple and executed. The boy was Jehoash, or Jehoash. It depends on how you pronounce it. And actually, there are two different spellings of his name in the Old Testament, but we won't worry about that. Jehoash. the older high priest is Jehoiada. I get these names mixed up, so I wrote them down carefully. Jehoiada. That's the priest. Well, he becomes the mentor to the young boy king. And in a sense, he's really ruling Israel as the boy's mentor. And he knows the Bible well, and the boy king and the priest, they get rid of the temple of Baal, they get rid of the priest of Baal, run him out of the country, at least that's kind of what it's worded. Anyway, they get rid of him, they tear down the statue of Baal, just falls right, they pull it down right on his own altar and burn it up and smash the little small idols into dust. And they bring Judah, back into compliance with God's pure religion for its day. And they have a number of decades of peace and blessings. The pattern you see in the Old Testament usually is something like this. It's not perfect, but if the king stays true to the pure religion, they're protected from their enemies and they're blessed. If the king starts to get into paganism, it doesn't take too many years and the morality of the nation goes down. They have internal problems and external invasion from the outside. Then something tragic happens. The older priest, Jehoiada, dies at age 130. He dies, age 130. And he's so beloved, they bury him in the tombs of the kings of Judah. That's how much they loved him. But you guessed it, within a few years, the king is now older, but now he has younger advisors, younger and more, probably the way they would see it, cooler and Intuit advisors. And they say to him, and they come and they flatter him, give him gifts, how wonderful he is. And they say, look, it's too difficult for the people to have to go all the way to Jerusalem to bring all their sacrifices and offerings. We have these high places all over Judah. Why can't they offer their sacrifice to the God of Israel in these high places? It'd be so much easier for them. Now, they had made this request before, we believe, except when the older high priest was there, he just said that it's not in God's law, we shouldn't do it. And the king, with his mentor's advice, who was with him, you know, since he was a little boy, he did the right thing. But without his mentor there, and this is always a problem with Israel and Judah, when they didn't get good leadership, it seemed like they didn't take long to go downhill. And that's the pattern you'll see in the Old Testament consistently. Anyway, you can read about some of that in 2 Kings 12, 1 and 2. But they come to him and they tell him that, you know, we want to be able to sacrifice anywhere. It's too difficult for a lot of people to come to the temple. It's costing too much money. We've got all these high places. The king, we believe, probably knew the law from his mentor. But they convinced him, you'll be so popular if you do this. You'll be so popular. And through flattery and bribes, he goes along with all the younger leaders. And they tell the people, you can sacrifice on all the high places. Now, most of these high places have been used by the pagans even before the Israelites got there. And whenever Israel slipped into idolatry, they used them. And probably maybe the first year or two, the people somewhat worship the true God in their own style on the high places. But we believe that there were men, at least some of them, who really wanted to bring back paganism, and that's why they made the request. But they did it secretly, of course. The thing about paganism and the Israelites, including Judah, that it's hard for us to understand, you know, because we don't have those same problems today. But I think they had a tendency to want to get away from the true God and go to paganism every opportunity they got. I mean, you can't deny that when you look at the overview of the Bible. And so, after a little while, the temple is neglected. Hardly anybody's going to the temple of God. They go to the high places. Before you know it, they're back into the pagan religions. And they're setting up Ashtaroth pole. Maybe some were even still left. They just had to repair them a little bit. And a lot of that is really phallic symbols and fertility rites. You know the whole, all the bad things, and they sacrificed children to prove they were all kinds of horrible things, and babies and stuff. There are a lot of reasons why God didn't like it. But the Israelites seem to love it. Now, I tried to think about why they did it, and I'm going to give you a few things to think about, but it's hard for us to perceive it in our day and age. There was a certain hedonism, that is sex and drinking and partying, or whatever you want to call it, that were part of those religions. They beat the drums and they danced, and I don't know how to describe it, but if you read about the pagan religions, some hedonistic fun they had. And a lot of people go to church for fun. Well, that may have been one attraction. I read another story where they said these Israelites, they were superstitious. They liked to have good luck charms. That's what we call them today. Read a story of this lady, and she had a little wooden carved Ashtaroth idol. And she had someone coated with silver. And she could wear it around her neck like a magic amulet. And supposedly it would make you fertile because you needed a lot of children to farm. And there were various other things that were supposed to make your farmland fertile. And people are still superstitious today. You know, they like having some metal thing they can put on their dashboard in front of their house or around their neck to make them feel that they've got a certain extra something with them. I know that. I know some athletes, certain things they wear, and they say, when I wear it, I tend to win, and they won't go play without it. So there's a certain love for the superstitious side of paganism. I think that was part of it. And then maybe there's one more part of it, too. I think the Israelites chafed under the laws of the true God. I don't think they really like, don't do this, don't do that, don't do the other thing. But, you know, God's laws are immutable. By that I mean, we're listening to this program, and the guy was saying, one of the problems with God's law is that you can do the wrong thing and get away with it. You think, well, you know, I lied to so-and-so and I got away with it. Or, I don't know. I guess I shouldn't talk about specific sins. Well, he's picking on me. But there are all kinds of things you can do secretly, or maybe with some people that aren't the best, and everybody won't find out about it. And you can probably even occasionally steal. They say criminals get away with quite a few crimes before they go to jail. You could probably even steal something you wanted, and you could probably get away with it. And you think, oh, I got away with it. But no, you don't get away with it. There's something automatic about God's law that when you lie, steal, cheat, or do things that alienate you from the true God, it takes a penalty. You just don't see it right away. And it's hard to explain it. But I don't think the Israelites liked the God's don'ts. You mean I can't get myself involved in some way out sex practices? There's a bunch of those laws. No. Not according to God's law. You can't do that. My only point is I think that was part of it too. And you can see some of all this described in 2 Chronicles 24. And so within a few years, all of a sudden, Judah went from pure religion to mostly worshiping paganism, just because they allowed them to disperse the religion and they didn't have, you know, a well-trained high priest controlling what was going on. Everybody kind of did his own thing. And that left plenty of room for people who wanted to lead them into paganism to do it. And apparently there are plenty of people who wanted to do it. And a lot of them who didn't mind being led into paganism either. Now, God sent some warning messages, and they were ignored. And then one day, I assume he was the high priest, or at least a very top-ranked priest, gave a speech in the temple where he specifically said, the leaders of Judah, and including the king, are allowing all this paganism. And the king was not happy about it. Let's go to 2 Chronicles 24. Now, when you read the Old Testament, you have to remember, they're recording many centuries of history in a short period of time, so you don't get a lot of details. But enough that we can see what's going on. 2 Chronicles 24, we're going to look at verse 19. 2 Chronicles 24:19, and it reads, yet he sent prophets, meaning God, to them to bring them again back unto the Lord. And the capital L-O-R-D, that's the word that we've talked about before. Strong says it's pronounced Jehovah, but nobody is sure. And the English version of that word is Jehovah. And the reason that's mentioned, because they were confused about who's the true God. And it was come back to the God of Israel, Jehovah or Jehovah, or there are other pronunciations of it as well, and not to Baal, Ashtaroth. And actually, they had a pantheon of pagan gods. Usually, they're written in little g. Little g means all the pagan gods. So God is saying, come back to the true God of Israel, the God of their fathers. And they serve groves and idols. And I don't even know how to explain it, but groves are certain kind of plants that they put in the high places where they went to worship all these pagan things. Serve groves and idols. And the wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem for their trespasses. In other words, bad things started to happen to Judah because of it. Yet he sent prophets to them to bring them again unto the Lord, and they testified against them, but they would not give ear. So, in other words, the prophets told them, you're wrong. Verse 20, and the Spirit of God came upon Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada, that's the older priest, the priest which stood above the people and said to them, I assume, and above, he's on a platform they had on the various courtyards in the temple, so all the crowd could see him speaking. I think that's what it's meant by above them. And probably thousands of people of Judah heard him. stood above the people and said to them, thus saith God, why transgressed you the commandments of the Lord, the God of Israel, that's why you cannot prosper, because you've forsaken the Lord. He has also forsaken you. Verse 21, and they conspired against him. We don't really have a lot of details, but probably the king was offended when he heard about this. And he and his princes said, we can't let him get away with saying we're allowing the people to go into paganism. Who does he think he is? I'm the king. You know, when you get to be a king, you don't like, you're thin-skinned about criticism. I even wonder if some of our leaders today are getting thin-skinned about criticism. This is a bad sign. If you run for high office, expect to get criticized. Anyway, the king didn't like it. So they probably got a mob of various kinds of people. Some people you can bribe, pay, and encourage to do anything you want. You'll see that in the Bible. And they stoned Zechariah. and they stoned him with stones at the command of the king in the court of the house of the Lord. Thus Joash, the king, remembered not the kindness which Jehoiada, his father, had done him. In other words, he killed the son of the man who saved his life from the evil queen. That's how corrupt the king got after his mentor had been away a few years. Maybe 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. It's kind of a shock, isn't it? It didn't take that many years once the good leadership was gone for the man to be corrupted. He killed the son of the man who saved his life, which Jehoiada, his father, had done him, but slew his son. And when he died, he said, the Lord look upon it and require it. In other words, he kind of said in his own way, if the stones are flying, don't worry about it. God's going to get the people who are behind this. And he did, of course. Now, I even wonder about our freedom of speech in this country. Are we free to criticize our leaders? It's a thought. You know, sometimes you go from the past, you look into the future. And they lost wars, and a lot of bad things happened to the boy king. And he got sick after some of his horrible military defeats. And while he was in bed, his own lieutenants assassinated him. Verse 25. We won't read it, but it's there. They assassinated him. And probably God allowed that because of the evil thing he did to the high priest who saved his life. It's a sad ending for the boy king. Now, you're going to say, well, what is the point of all this for us today? Because, well, we're not in that kind of a situation. Well, have you ever wondered why in the Old Testament God had a centralized temple-centered religion? That was, everything is temple-centered. You ever wondered why that exists? This story that I just read about the boy king is why. And by the way, his son did the same thing. We'll get to that in a minute. After the king was assassinated, even though he wasn't a Baal worshiper, he allowed the people to worship Baal in high places, and it poisoned Judah. And eventually, that poisoning was so bad that God just sent him off into captivity and dispersion. Here's what the story, I think, illustrates. One, the need for quality control when it comes to the worship of God. Quality control. Two, a temple where all the sacrifices were done. And those sacrifices at the temple ultimately pointed to Jesus Christ. The temple was like a stage. And I know the people of Judah even now don't yet understand it, but they will. And then it'll all click into place. Everything that happened to the temple really pointed to Jesus Christ when you understand it ultimately. And three, frankly, the people could not be trusted on their own to keep their religion pure. Isn't it that simple? The people on their own cannot be trusted. Now, I've been in the ministry for 33 years, and I've seen many splinter groups. I really have seen many splinter groups. They always drift into false doctrine. Now, why? Maybe each one is a unique story. I'm not saying they're all, but there's a pattern. Usually either the leader, the guy they follow, or the one who leads them out, at some point, either before he leads them out or after they left, he comes up with an idea baby. That's one of GTA's terms, idea baby. Some new doctrine that's going to show how special I am. And there's a little bit of vanity in that, if you can see what I mean, intellectual, spiritual vanity. He comes up with an idea baby, and it leads him to false doctrines. By the way, if you want to read about his son, but we don't need to read about 2 Kings 14, 1 through 4. But the last verse, the key verse, it mentions that he didn't stop them from worshiping pagan idols in the high places. So the same pattern continued. And that was just a problem that Judah had. And that's why Judah was eventually expulsed from the Holy Land, their expulsion, and dispersed. Now, so I think we can see why God required a temple-centered religion. Because in the temple, they had a well-trained priest. Actually, at least when it was working as supposed to, not only were those priests well-trained, they were disciplined by God. If they did something wrong, like there's an example of Aaron's two sons start taking bribes, and they start playing games with a fire, a certain holy fire you have to keep going. Oh, it doesn't matter. It's only the temple of God. Out of the temple came lightning and struck him dead. And sometimes God or an angel representing him was actually in the temple in the Holy of Holies, and God doesn't tolerate any nonsense. You know that when the high priest on the Day of Atonement walks into the Holy of Holies, there's a rope on his leg. Some of you know why the rope is there. He has certain things he's supposed to do. He only gets to go in there one time a year. And he has to do certain ritualistic things, and he has to be dressed in pure white linen and totally clean himself and sacrifice for his own sin before he's worthy to go in there. If he doesn't do the right thing, God strikes him dead. And the other lesser priests, they can't go in because they're not allowed to. They have to pull him out by a rope. I'm not making that up. So God, maybe God didn't always do that. I'm not saying God was always with the Jewish people in the temple. Maybe you could argue more so at some times than others. But at least when Solomon dedicated the temple, God himself, the glow was there. He came to that temple, and that temple represents God's presence there. And he disciplined the priest. So the priest knew the rules. And most of the time, they knew the Bible, and most of the time, the high priest followed it. I'm not going to say perfectly, but they did a pretty decent job. And as far as God's concerned, there's a greater chance But if you do it at the temple where God is there and the high priest who's well-trained, and the Jews are good at that sort of thing. He knows what he's supposed to do. There's all kinds of special gold and rituals and things that the priests wear and all that. They know what they're supposed to do, and they do it. You're not going to have room for pagan ceremonies. But if you let the people do their own thing all over the countryside, it's like opening yourself up for paganism and all the bad things which will follow paganism. Let's go to Deuteronomy 12. I want to just show you some of the specifics on a simple temple-centered religion, and that it's in the Bible. Because you don't think, he's just saying that. I'm going to show you clearly, Moses actually went out of his way, kind of beat the point to death. And Deuteronomy is called the second giving of the law, where he iterates some things they're supposed to do when they go into the Holy Land. Because it's given to them in those 40 days right before Joshua led them into the Holy Land. So he's telling them, here's what you do before you go into when you get to the Promised Land. Because when they were in tents camping, it was somewhat of a different situation. Though they did have a tabernacle, but anyway. Deuteronomy 12, we're going to pick it up in verse 3. And you shall overthrow their altars, meaning all the pagan altars that are on all the high hills when you conquer that land. You shall destroy all the place. He didn't want it left as a historical monument to what the pagans did. He said, don't even ask what they do. Destroy it. You shall overthrow their altars, break their pillars, burn their groves with fire. You shall hew down the graven images, because many of them were wood, of their gods, and destroy the names of them out of that place. And then in verse 5, he says, but unto the place. Now, the place means either at first it was the tabernacle, but then when they built the temple on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, which was picked by David and obviously blessed by God, and probably the same place that Abraham went with Isaac, because God is very methodical in the stuff he does, the holy place. But unto the place which the Lord your God shall choose out of all your tribes to put his name there, even unto his habitation shall you seek, and thither shall you come. I often wonder, why is the the Dome of the Rock right there on the holy site? I know the devil knows that that's a special site to God. And when God let the devil have control of that part of the world, the devil put his stamp on it. And if the Jews even once they wanted to dedicate a rock to think about the temple, the Arabs rioted. Hundreds of people were killed. You know how that sort of thing is, though. I think most of us have learned from this threatened book burning how they are. So the devil knows how important that place is, too. Verse 8, you shall not do after all these things we do here this day. Every man whatsoever is right in his own eyes. In other words, God is saying, don't do your own thing religiously. You know, like, well, I kind of make up my own kind of cafeteria religion. A little bit of this, a little bit of that. A lot of people that way. No, God says, you do what I tell you to do. Verse 11, then there shall be a place which the Lord your God shall choose to cause his name to dwell there. Thither shall you bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, your heave offerings, your hand, and all your choice vows which you vow unto the Lord. Notice again, bring it to the temple right there in Jerusalem. Verse 14. But in the place, I'm emphasizing the words to make the point, in the place which the Lord shall choose in one of your tribes, eventually it became Judah and Jerusalem, but at first it was a tabernacle, admittedly, a portable temple. But in the place which the Lord shall choose in one of thy tribes, there you shall offer your burnt offerings, and thou shalt do all that I command you. So, again, you're saying, boy, he's really making the point, isn't he? Well, so he doesn't misunderstand. Let's go to verse 18. Just in case you didn't get the point that Moses is making. Verse 18. But you must eat them before the Lord. And that means, because if we assume that God's in the temple or an angel representing him is in there, because it often would glow and stuff, So when you eat at the temple, in the temple area, you're eating before God. That's what he's saying. Before the Lord, you know, the God of Israel, your God, in the place which the Lord your God shall choose, you and your son and your daughter, your manservant and your maidservant, the Levite that is within your gates, you shall rejoice before the Lord. That means in the temple area in Jerusalem. Thy God and all that you puttest your hand also to do. So Moses is really driving the point home, isn't he? Now let's go to Deuteronomy 16, 5 and 6. Deuteronomy 16, 5. Thou mayest not sacrifice the Passover within your gates, which the Lord your God has given you. There's actually a 500-page book written by a guy that I think is a spiritual wolf. And he has a theory that Passover is supposed to be done in everybody's home. But that clearly just said the opposite, didn't it? It said, you shall not sacrifice the Passover within your gates, which the Lord your God has given you, but at the place, verse 16, I actually circled the word, so I would emphasize, at the place which the Lord thy God shall choose to place his name, in there that thou shalt sacrifice the Passover at evening. We went through that a while back. That's like 3:30. They call it the evening sacrifice. Probably 2 hours or so before sunset. They would sacrifice the official Passover lamb. Then they had to bleed it appropriately. Then you've got to gut it and dress it and roast it. Now it's going to take a few hours. And then the sun would set, and they had the blood in all the right places. And they would eat it that evening, which is the beginning of unleavened bread. So Passover and unleavened bread meld into one season. And by the way, you'll see it mentioned in the New Testament. And sometimes they'll say the days of unleavened bread, and they mean all 7 days. Or they'll say the Passover, they mean all 7 days by the context. It'll confuse you. The Passover is a sacrifice, an official sacrifice of the temple. Now, they had to do the lambs probably starting in the afternoon for many, many hours because there were so many Israelites, and had to have many, many priests to help them in line. You know, so it was a big operation. But the official lamb was sacrificed at the temple at about what they call the evening sacrifice. Anyway, we went through that, but we can go over it again. We get back to the spring to remind you, even though certain people don't want to believe that. Let's go to verse 16. This is Deuteronomy 16:16, which is easy to remember. We have to do our holy day offerings. We'll probably do one next week. If you don't have much money to worry about, just put a $5 bill in an envelope. We'll give, put your name and address on it. You know, the widow's mite means a lot to God, so don't worry about the amount. Anyway, 3 times in a year shall all your males, males almost had to go. Women didn't have to go, but most of them went. The males were head of the families, and they had, you know. But so most everybody in the family went. We'll show you that a little bit later. Appear before the Lord, that means at the temple, thy God, in the place which he shall choose, and the feast of unleavened bread. Now that means the entire thing, Passover and the 7 days of unleavened bread. It's a time period. It's a seasonal celebration. And in the feast of weeks, that's Pentecost. You know, when you get to the seventh week and then the next day, we call it Pentecost weekend because you have back-to-back Sabbaths, Saturday and Sunday. So we call it Pentecost weekend, but it's the same thing. And in the Feast of Tabernacles, where we'll be going on the, well, we will arrive the evening of the 22nd, but starts on the 23rd. If you can't afford to go, I understand, but if you can go. At any rate, so those are the three holy seasons when they were supposed to go to Jerusalem. The religion was Jerusalem-centered, where a well-trained high priest could keep the religion pure. And I really believe that's the purpose of it. Feast of Tabernacles, thou shalt not appear before the Lord empty. And if you can't go, maybe you can keep the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles, the holy day, at home and get extra tapes, and we can give you some. Remind me to bring some extra tapes and DVDs that you can borrow and look at during that period if you can't go. And they went before the God of Israel was at the temple. Let's go to, let's go to 17:17 in Deuteronomy. Now, these are rules for the king, but the priest and the kings, both were supposedly there in Jerusalem, We're supposed to both know this. Now, I know when you read this, and if you read even earlier verses, you'll see that the kings of Israel often didn't do this, but they were supposed to. 17:17. Neither shall he multiply wives to himself. In other words, the king should not build a big harem. In those days, kings had that kind of power and money. They could afford it. But that God said not to do it. And you know what happened when even one of the greatest kings of all time, Solomon, broke that law. It ruined him spiritually in his older age. Anyway, you can't have too many wives. It's not good for you. Anyway, multiply wives to himself, that his heart turn not away, neither shall he greatly multiply himself gold and silver. In other words, the king shouldn't be guilty from, he shouldn't be greedy for money or greedy for women. I'm putting it bluntly. Verse 18, and he shall be, when he sits upon the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write a copy of the law, which they made it, the Jews made that a tough job. Every page had to be perfect or you'd do it all over again. If you ever had to write it out in Hebrew, you can see it written out. It's a real artwork. They had to write, I think that meant the first five books of the Bible. That's the law. The king had to write all that stuff out, and I assume do it correctly, under the guidership of the priest. And can you see how good that would be for a young king to have to do that? write him a copy of the law. By the way, books were not readily available because printing didn't exist. Copies of the Bible were on sacred scrolls, very expensive. Most people didn't have them. But at least the king would have his own copy because he wrote it out himself. You see the genius of that? Of course, the priests had some copies that were in the temple, of course. But actually, printing was a great thing for the world when the common man could have the Bible. But that didn't come for about another 2,000 or so years, maybe 3,000 or so years from that point. And it shall be with him, and he shall read them all the days of his life, that he may learn. So why should the king read the copy of the law? So he could learn to fear the Lord his God, to keep all the words of this law and these statutes, to do them. And I think when they did what they were supposed to do, the king knew the law, the priest knew the law, and the religion was centered in Jerusalem where they were. And they could keep the religion pure. And it worked, and then Israel was blessed. Verse 20, that his heart be not lifted above his brethren. In other words, you don't want the king to get thinking he's special and arrogant, because then he can't be a good ruler. I wonder if any of our congressmen are thinking they're above the law. Well, sometimes it makes you wonder. They pass laws and they exempt themselves. We're not all smiling. I know everybody loves their congressman, but okay, back to the point. That his heart be not lifted up above his brethren, that he turn not aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, to the end or to the goal, that he may prolong his days in the kingdom and his children in the midst of Israel. In other words, stay balanced on the law. Not too extreme, right, left. Stay balanced on the law and the way you administer so that you'll have a long life and your children and your kingdom will be blessed. That's really what it's saying. Now, what about Christ? What did Christ do for the Passover? Let's go to Luke 2, verse 41. Because people will argue this one too. But I just thought when I looked at this scripture, I know people try to explain it away. And you know they spend hundreds of pages trying to explain stuff away, which ought to make you suspicious. Read Luke 2:41. We're going to read Luke 2:41 and 42. Luke 2:41 reads, now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. So what did his parents do? Did they keep the feast at home? No, they kept it every year in Jerusalem. Now, let me just make a point. If you're God and you're going to send your son to live as a human being, aren't you going to give him pretty good parents? Remember when Joseph thought Mary was pregnant and had been playing around? He was such a gracious man, he was not going to ask her to be stoned to death, which he could have, theoretically, or other charges that would have humiliated her and made her life horrible. He was going to do it quietly because he was a kind man. And actually, there's a lot of positive things you can say about Joseph and Mary both. They're godly people. God would not have chosen them if they were not godly people. Think about it. So if anybody wants to say, well, they were wrong, you better think twice about that. God would not have chosen them if they weren't what they were supposed to be. Anyway, verse 42. And when he was 12 years old, he went up to Jerusalem after the custom of the feast. In case some of you think, well, Christ was young, he didn't know what his parents were doing there wrong. In this very example that he's talking about, verse 49, and he's talking to all the priests and doctors of the law at the temple, and he said unto them, how is it that you sought me? Did you not know that I must be about my Father's business? In other words, his goal was to start teaching the truth. He probably was only 12 or 13. I think it said 12, but whatever. Yeah, 12. And at that age, Jewish boys become accountable. And he started talking to the priest at the temple. And as you read the whole story, they were amazed. You were this 12-year-old, his understanding. So obviously Christ understood. If his parents were wrong, he should have told them. We should be keeping this Passover at home. Because this guy who's going to write a 500-page book in 2,000 years from now says so. Now, let me go to another point. They also say, some of it's a little bit anti-Semitic, they say that the Jewish people screwed up the calendar and they were off a day or so on the Passover. They didn't know what they were doing and the law was messed up. By the way, do you know that one of the favorite books quoted by Christ, he actually quoted this when he's being tempted by the devil, was Deuteronomy. The guy in the 500-page book challenges the veracity of Deuteronomy. He goes through long, tortured explanations as to why Ezra got it all wrong and why Ezra and Nehemiah were wrong. You know how the audacity of saying a prophet of God is wrong? Now, maybe we could say we don't fully understand him yet, but to say he's wrong, I think, whoa, I'd be afraid to say that. But it's in his book. I mean, he does it in clever, drawn-out ways, but he does say it. And I just want to make that point. You have to check commentaries on it, but you will find that Deuteronomy was a favorite book. Like, you know, when Christ said, you don't live by bread alone, he took that directly out of Deuteronomy. And he quoted it, people list all the quotes Christ made. That was one of his favorite books. Well, if Deuteronomy is untrustworthy, how come Christ didn't know it? Okay, getting back to the question of were the Jews all mixed up and the Old Testament all screwed up? Let me just say this. There's no evidence in the entire New Testament that the apostles challenge the Jewish people regarding the calendar, the holy days, the timing, and things of that nature. There's nothing. As a matter of fact, all the evidence is they were keeping the same days. Let me give you one example, though there's more than one. But we only have time for one. Let's go to Acts 21. We're going to look at just one to make the point, in case anyone ever tells you, well, there's a lot of anti-Semitism out there, too, that people can play on. It's true that God blinded the Jews that they did not recognize that Christ was the Messiah. But Paul says in Romans that was God's will. And God has blinded even many of the great religious teachers in our world. They just don't see certain things, and God has allowed it. So, you know, how you can always debate the why and where, but they were right about certain things. Jews are good with astronomy and math, and they didn't mess it up. Okay, Acts 21, verse 20. Now, Paul had just told them of all the many Gentiles, uncircumcised, by the way, that he's converting to Christianity, really changing the face of Christianity. It's got now thousands of Gentiles and churches all over the Roman Empire. Paul and his associates started. And so, verse 20, he's come back to Jerusalem, and the other apostles, at least the leading ones, are meeting with them. And they say, and when they heard it, they glorified the Lord and said unto him, you see, brother, how many thousands of Jews there are which believe and are all zealous of the law. In other words, they're saying, we've converted thousands of Jews here in Jerusalem, and they're zealous for the law. Now, if the law was done away, wouldn't, because these are the leaders, you know, John, James, and Peter, and maybe other leaders that we're not sure of, but, you know, they were there, wouldn't they know it? And this is 30 years after Christ was nailed to the stake, give or take a year. And they say these Christian Jews are zealous for the law, and they don't say anything's wrong with it. And let me read the rest of the story to make the point. They're informed of you, I mean, that is Paul, that you teach all the Jews which are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses. Now, when they say Moses, they mean the first five books of the Bible written by Moses. Actually, it's God's law, but Moses wrote it, and they kind of give him the credit for it. But we all know that, I think. But Moses was a great man, though. Among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying that they ought not to circumcise their children, neither to walk after the custom. Now, it's true that they made an exception to circumcision, but even that's in the law. Because in Deuteronomy, Moses wrote, circumcise your heart, not just your flesh. And as long as they were circumcised in their heart, that's what really counted. But they didn't understand that, and that's one of those problems with the Jewish nation of the time. And so his enemies were saying, well, if they didn't circumcise these Gentiles, then that means he's against the laws of God, which, of course, was heresy. That's not true. But that was the accusation, because they wanted to stop that and make everybody become a Jew first, and then they could get into the church. I mean, that's what the Judaizing party wanted. So here's what they say. What is it, therefore? The multitude must needs come together, and they're going to hear that you're come. Paul was so famous in the Jewish community, there's no way he could slip into town and be unnoticed. I don't know if we have an example of that today, but I don't know who the most famous person in this country is. Bill O'Reilly, I don't know, Peyton Manning, whoever you think. There's some famous people. If they came to St. Louis or Cape Girardeau, some major city, believe me, people would find out. I saw him at the airport. There'd be crowds. So Paul was too famous to get in and out without people knowing it. Verse 23, do therefore this that we say to you. We have four men which have a vow on them. This is a temple vow, temple stuff. Take them and purify yourself with them and be at charges with them, that they may shave their heads, like I have shaved my head, as a matter of fact. They do that for a special purity vow. Maybe that's good for me, to shave my head. I'm just kidding. anyway, shave their heads, and all may know that those things whereof they're informed concerning you are nothing. In other words, do this, Paul, so they'll know that you're not against the first five books of the Bible. You're not against Deuteronomy. You're not against the law. And Paul does it. Now, it doesn't really work because I think there's an anti-Gentile sentiment in Judaism that comes out later in the story that overrides the truth. So the truth, but it's clear, very clear. They made an exception of circumcision. But basically, you read everything else, all the other stuff stands. They should learn that every Sabbath. And the New Testament church, remember, Paul is the man who wrote most of the New Testament. Here you see him doing things to prove he is not against the way the Jews are, as far as holy days and the way they're running the temple. He's not against it. That's pretty clear. I mean, there's no way you can argue your way out of it. You know, you can take people's words out of context and misunderstand them. But here's what the man is actually doing. So why am I saying all this? Because the guy with the 500-page book is challenging Ezra and Nehemiah. He says they messed it all up because his pet idea that home-centered Passover is what we really should do and not, you know, the temple-centered or the group-centered Passover. And he basically, if you take his approach, anything that he doesn't like in any of the first five, or any of the books of the Bible, he also challenges Second Chronicles because there are some temple-centered Passovers that are very special in their as Israel comes back and reestablishes a true religion. And he doesn't like that either because that messed with his theory. So he basically says the writers were totally wrong. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because these people are operating in this area, and they're going to be operating at the feast, and you are the target. They're not going to come to me because I believe they know I know better, but they're going to be after you. And then the book is clever, and those 500 pages you get all confused and just wear you out reading it. But I'm telling you the truth. It was a temple-centered Passover, and the plain, clear scriptures should not be undone by someone with a 500-page clever assault on them. Because if it takes you that many pages to explain away clear scriptures, something is wrong. So stick with the pure, true religion.